Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Today, I am talking to Eric Galletta, a builder down in Southern California who sort of bridges the gap between what Paul Bigsby and R.C. Allen were doing, along with some of the more forward-thinking shredder kind of guitar makers. Eric knew a lot of these guys. He worked alongside Bernie Rico from BC Rich as well as Wayne Charvel. And then he found R.C. Allen, and the rest is kind of history. And the reason that we're talking to him today is because one of his guitars was featured in the Fretboard Journal's 2018 Electric Guitar Annual. It is a guitar based on a Bigsby that Rye Cooter was borrowing when we stopped by and visited him. And Rye was singing the guitar's praises, which was more than enough of an endorsement for me to want to hear more about it. So I wanted to reach out to Eric and hear his story. I'll be honest, I'm not sure Eric knew we were recording this conversation. I told him that was for a podcast. I think he thought that we were going to do some other interview later on down the line, and this was just some sort of preliminary thing. But that's not how we work here at the Fretboard Journal. I just record that first conversation. I ran it by Eric. He said that it was cool to run by you guys. So I hope you like this unfiltered, uncensored glimpse into the life of one of the great California guitar makers. It is a fun story. I am staring at a pallet full of Fretboard Journal 43s. The Fretboard Journal 43 is finally back from the printer. If you are a subscriber, it is en route to you right now. Don't blow up my inbox yet wondering where it is. It is en route to you. Sometimes the Postal Service takes 5 to 10 days or longer to deliver these magazines. So patience, grasshoppers. If you haven't subscribed yet, though, now is an awesome time to do so. We will mail you this issue. I can tell you now, spoiler alert, Billy Strings is on the cover, and it is not the Billy Strings story that you think it might be. So it's a fun issue. You're going to love it. Subscribe at fretboardjournal.com. Use the coupon code podcast, and I will take $5 off of your order. And I am also packing up some magazines to take to the NAMM show. We're going to the NAMM show next weekend. It's going to be filled with all sorts of product unveils and marketing talks and editorial talks and all the talks that I have to go through, all the meetings. But I am going to be posting as many updates as I humanly can on our Instagram page, which is just Fretboard Journal. In other news, the Fretboard Journal's podcast with Skip Simmons is now up and running. If you haven't tuned into The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons, I encourage you to do so. It is a lot of fun. And if anybody is listening to this and wants to sponsor any of these podcasts, the Skip Simmons podcast, Luthier on Luthier, the Fretboard Journal podcast that you're listening to right now, reach out to me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. We'll walk you through the process. We would love to have some new partners for 2019, and we would love to help you share your story. So that's the spiel from this end. Here is my conversation with Eric Galletta. So I want to talk to you about that guitar that Ray had, but before I get to all that and kind of the Bigsby line of things, what am I distracting you from right now? What's on your workbench? What should you be working on instead of talking to me?
Well, I tell you what, I'm not at my workbench. I'm at my buddy's over at the winery. I frequent, and a good friend in the winemaking business. So I'm just here at his place kicking back and, you know, anticipating your phone call.
Where's this winery?
It's actually in Hemet, okay. California, Southern California. And he's got a heck of a winery, private winery, all organic. So I've been having my hands involved in the vineyard, tending the vineyard.
Wow. This is not far from where you live, right?
It's basically in the same town I live.
Yeah. And are you an aspiring winemaker, or are you kind of tending to the grapes? What are you up to?
I'm so enthralled by it. I've been telling people the closest to God you can get is, you know, being in the vineyard, tending the grapes or petting elephants, you know? It's an amazing thing. It really is. The
nice.
The whole process is. And he's very magical. And he planted this vineyard in... Here we're talking about wine. He planted in 2012, and his first year vintage was 2015, won platinum and a silver in the international contest.
Nice.
Nice. Yeah.
Is this guy a guitar guy?
No.
No.
No, not
right.
at all.
All right. We don't care about him. We'll move on.
Yeah.
So
the wine is good.
The wine is good, though. Okay. What's the name of the winery? You might as well ask.
Tranquil Heart Winery.
Okay. So I know you have this whole facet of your guitar making that is sort of dedicated to the guitars and the style of what Paul Bigsby made. But I know a little bit about you, and your guitar making goes way back further than that. When did you take up guitar making?
Around 86, 87 in that area.
All right. And were you a musician? Were you just a woodworker? Where were you coming from?
I grew up with music, high school bands. I was actually a woodwind instrument.
Is that in Southern California?
Where? Yeah.
Okay.
In the same place, Hemet.
Okay. Hemet. Oh, lifelong Hemeter.
Yeah, well, I mean, in and out, yeah.
Yeah.
All over Southern California.
And what made you pick up a chisel or a saw or whatever got you going?
Always been into music, always been into rock bands and whatnot, and friends playing music, and got me interested in, we came up with a finish. A seashell finish. My uncle turned me on to, and we ended up elaborating on it and covering guitar bodies in natural seashells.
Okay. What was your uncle going to do with this?
Well, he was in the furniture making business. My mom's background.
Okay.
Family comes up, furniture makers and the sort.
And so go ahead.
Yeah, we developed this guitar finish made out of natural seashells.
I'm trying to envision this. Is this like a giant pick guard, or is this a moldable, flexible thing?
You know, basic like Abalam, but the whole body is covered.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, way before, the Duke of Pearl was doing Abalam even. I think we really inspired him to develop and further develop that whole thing when they seen our products.
Wow. And so then you had to make guitars.
Yeah, so I started making some guitars, and I was just tooling around and made a few prototypes and didn't know what the hell I was doing at all. Just thought this was like the coolest thing, you know, seashells on the guitar and whatnot. And my father it was a physician, non-guitar player, non-musical. And he had a mutual friend that introduced me to Wayne Charvel. And I approached Wayne with it and asked his ideas about what kind of crazy stuff I'm getting into. But the guy that introduced me to Wayne Charvel, Gerald Sanders, who was in the Tornadoes, a band called the Tornadoes, but it was a good friend of my dad's. He wrote a hit song called Bustin' Surfboards back in the day. It's instrumental.
And so did you team up with Charvel?
Eventually I did. I was telling Wayne, I got this idea. Talked about them about the, you know, how this would affect the sonic capabilities of a solid body guitar, and actually won him over by proving him wrong. he thought it was going to kill the vibration of the body and the sound, and a little bit more development and we found out actually the exact opposite. These things are just amazing. Um, we just got a lot more sustain and resonance out of the instrument by encapsulating the guitar body in natural seashell veneer.
So, yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Wayne was, he was like, wow, it's the exact opposite, and kind of dumbfounded over, you know, his claim to think that, oh, it's just going to kill the sound. The string's not going to vibrate, you know, as long. And like I said, again, we found out the exact opposite.
Did he end up using a lot of this stuff?
We end up actually teaming up.
Okay.
From that, we developed a Ritz, R-I-T-Z, Ritz Guitar Company, his name. He thought of, forgot what other name he was thinking of. I mean, you're bringing back some memories, so I got like, Wayne was a hot rodder. He was buying, selling cars and flipping cars and making guitars when I met him. He was just transitioning into another shop when I met him in Calamasa, California, which is about half an hour away from me.
And I have to imagine being around him and kind of seeing how things are done on that level. Did that raise your guitar making game?
Yeah. I mean, I was able to apprentice under him and learn a lot of stuff and learn the art. And he was just, Charvel guitars were big then. And when we met him, we found the exact opposite because we brought a Charvel guitar Strat, you know, super Strat over to him and wanted him to sign it and everything. You know, you made this, Wayne, you know, we want you to sign it, my buddy and I. And Wayne was going, well, you know, I didn't make that. And this was after, you know, after he sold Charvel Manufacturing to Grover Jackson.
Okay.
It was after that transition of him selling Charvel Manufacturing and finding out later on that he lost his name, you know, to Grover.
Sure.
Because he sold Charvel and he couldn't use Charvel. Not realizing it. Wayne wasn't the businessman in that regard.
Guitar makers rarely are.
Yeah, they rarely are, I tell you. You know, they're all art. Sorry about that. They're all, we're all artists and inherently.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you don't think of the business side, and boy, have I gone and learned a lot about the music industry and the politics and throughout this whole thing, even with Wayne.
Yeah.
Because about that time, he just signed on with, Henry Jeskowitz, and they were making the WRC too.
Okay.
So we had, simultaneously parallel, we had Ritz guitars and WRC guitars, Gibson.
Wow.
You know, all of a sudden these guys were like, oh, you know, Grover Jackson and Super Strat, and, you know, Gibson's got to make some Strats. You know, this is when Henry first took over. And his guy, Paul Jernigan, too, they approached Wayne, and they signed Wayne to compete with Grover. And said, you know, basically we have the real Wayne Charvel, you know, the innovator, the guy, the hot rodder, you know, the master, basically. And Wayne won. Wayne was super genius. Like Paul Bigsby, super genius. Wayne was just amazing.
And you're kind of along for the ride, the new guy, kind of experiencing all these deals.
Experiencing and seeing what's shaking. Really close to Wayne. Wayne was like a big brother, not really a dad, but a big brother to me.
And how big was the Charvel operation or whatever it ended up being called? Was there like a dozen of you guys?
It was small.
Yeah.
We were in a building in Calmesa Boulevard, and but we were doing repairs and custom work and one-offs, and Wayne was a master at that stuff, man. He would just, like, draw the stuff up and just zip, 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 and, you know, we got something to go by. And Gibson seen that, you know, Gibson seen all that.
Yeah.
And this was actually after he just got done tooling Bernie Rico's shop too.
Okay.
BC Ridge. So he was, he was freelancing and here, there, everywhere. Wayne was really responsible for a lot of development in Southern California.
Yeah.
Through a lot of these mates. I mean, Seymour, him and Seymour Duncan were buddies, and he actually gave, I think, first winding machine to Seymour.
Wow. And were you, you ended up working for BC Rich, right?
I did. Later on, I worked with Bernie. When he came back from Class X, he licensed it in the name. I remember when Wayne and I went to go see him at his shop in El Monte, and he was going out, so he sold us a bunch of stuff. And he loved Wayne, so he was like, Wayne, whatever you want, just take it and this and that, and we'll work it out later. And he was done. He was done with the guitar business, Bernie was. I mean, I'll never forget that day. He's underneath a pin router, and he lifted up his head and hit his head pretty good on the pin router. And Bernie was a hot chili pepper. He was something. So he got up from that thing. He beat up that damn machine with a couple necks, a couple guitars, because he hit his head. He was so pissed and swung a guitar across the room. I mean, it was really rock and roll. Rich. That guy was something. But later on, he came back and got the name back from Class X. They messed it all up. And when he came back, Wayne was making a transition. He was going up north, and I was just like, oh, man, I'm by myself. And I'm in the same shop and whatnot, and Bernie was coming back in, and Wayne, he wanted to move back to Southern California, and Wayne said, well, move in with Eric, you know, he owned the shop. So Bernie moved in with me.
Okay.
And I helped Bernie, reestablish BC Rich at the time, coming back his transition.
Now,
and helping him.
Just so I know, like, all along this time, at some point when working with Wayne, were you building your own guitars too and trying to kind of figure out your own branding and everything?
Well, along with Wayne, yeah, I'm always coming up with ideas, and we collaborate. I do certain parts of the jobs and building bodies and et cetera. He'd do other parts, and we developed the Ritz Guitar Company, and it had some investor come in, and they got involved. So this was my first getting wet into the industry and finding out, the hard way how things work.
Sure.
I was just a kid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we started Ritz, and then I was able later on to acquire the WRC trademark off of Gibson. I negotiated the WRC, which was Wayne Richard Charvel.
Sure.
And they were going out there and saying, they called the Gibson guitar WRC, Wayne Richard Charvel, Super Strat, And they started that angle of trying to win people over to Gibson by building this hot rod Super Strat WRC, Wayne Charvel. And then all the lawsuits incurred, you can't use Charvel. So they had to make disclaimers, in their advertising. Wayne Charvel. I mean, it was pretty kind of forceful kind of disclaimers of Wayne Charvel is not and has never been associated with Jackson guitars,
All the fun stuff you never think about when you decide you want to make a guitar.
Yeah, it was like immediately. It was all the politics and all the business we're not talking slouch companies. I mean, Gibson and these guys are coming back in and just like trying to find angles. Henry with his bright ideas of getting Super Strat Gibsons. And at the time, I didn't realize that stuff,
Yeah.
I was just on the coattails of Wayne Charvel's life and just going through the ride.
In hindsight, was it worth buying back the brand and going through all those hurdles?
We came up with selling the agreement. I was able to get an attorney, a friend of mine, and he became Wayne's attorney. And he was very musical. My buddy Michael, his attorney, had bands and, you know, little studio and, you know, geeking out on guitar gear. And I was like, oh, Wayne Charvel, yeah, I'll handle your stuff, you know.
Got it.
So I had Michael batting for him, and we ended up settling with Gibson after a while, and I was able to get that trademark for $1.
Oh, not a bad deal. I mean, I'm sure there were some lawyer fees, but yeah.
And all the goodwill and everything, after everything was said and done. And then we started WRC Guitars, WRC Music. And we made WRC instruments, Wayne Richard Charvel.
Wow. And how big an operation was that? You two?
It was just us two and maybe a couple other guys. We had Alan Hamill remember Fender Custom Shop, Alan Hamill?
Yeah.
He came into the shop, and then him and Wayne were doing like a little side school thing, guitar school, Alan Hamill and Wayne Charvel. And so we had these guys come in that were workman's comp stuff, and they were teaching them how to, you know, get into the business of guitar making. The illustrious business of guitar makers. And so we had all these guys in the interim, and Wayne would put them to work on some stuff and teach them, you know, how to route bodies and et cetera, all the fun stuff. And actually they'd complete a guitar, and that was part of the whole workman's comp type of re-educating these hurt guys from job-related injuries or something.
Yeah.
So
at what point, I mean, I'm picturing the names you're mentioning, I'm picturing you're mainly building, you know, metal, hard rock guitars. At what point did sort of the guitars of Paul Bigsby into your life?
Well, during that time, I met a friend who became a dear friend, one of my closest friends to this day, is Michael O'Dorn. And Michael and I was young, and Michael was going through a divorce, and we lived in the guitar shop.
Nice.
It's crazy to say all this stuff to you, Jason. It's like amazing memories. But Michael lived in the guitar shop.
Do you have a shower?
No, actually, we had a buddy that we do. I mean, we were hobos, living like hobos. And get this, we're living like hobos in the shop, and we have a potbelly stove and a couple cots. Michael is a master jeweler of the highest order. Okay, so he moved in the back of the shop. He moved all his jewelry business into the back of the shop. And at the same time, Michael, he's a master fingerstyle guitarist and was heavily influenced by Merle Travis.
Okay.
So we're living there, and all I hear is this Merle Travis stuff, day in and day out. Merle Travis, Tread Atkins, Marcel Dotti, on and on. His Super 400 is... So he's playing all this Merle Travis all the time, and you know, at night we'd have a couple of beers and hang around like hobos, and I mean, we're really just like doing it. And I had a motorhome, a little motorhome outside that I stayed in once in a while. And so I'd do like 3 or 4 days, and we'd pump out some work, and then I'd go back home to Hemet, and then Michael was there pretty much all the time because he was going through just a terrible divorce. And he was actually spinning records of Merle Travis when he was 6.
Wow.
Which leads me to Michael O'Dorn is a great Fretboard Journal story.
All right.
I would not be doing what I do without Michael O'Dorn.
Good to know. All right.
I love the guy to pieces. He's the Mel Bay author for getting into Travis picking. And he's fulfilled all his dreams. It's just amazing. So from six, him and his dad listening to Merle Travis and is just putting the needle back and forth on Merle Travis. Now, he is the authority on Merle Travis, Tread Atkins Appreciation Society teacher now.
Okay.
And just amazing to see all this happen, you know, over the years. he was asked by Chet to teach Merle Travis.
Wow.
And, you know, you could ask Tom Brush, or you want to know anything about Merle, ask Michael O'Dorn, you know. That he's the resident Merle Travis dude for Cass.
Is he an older guy than you, or were you guys about the same age?
4 years. He's almost 70, I think.
Okay,
now.
Yeah.
No, he was older than me.
Yeah.
And he's like my personal Rain Man. He's a genius. And he's a master jeweler. I mean, I don't know if that Glen Campbell album, I forget the name of it, but he presented Glen Campbell with a peace sign, and he's wearing a turtleneck. I forget which album that is. But that's Michael's art that he gave Glen, and he wore it on the cover of his album. He's made works for Merle Travis, R.C. Allen, Tom Brush, the Duolette necklace that Tom Brush plays. It's all gold. Michael made it.
Wow.
He told Michael, he goes, I'll retire this. You make me that Duolette. And he's been wearing that for, 20 years probably now. Around his neck. You know the Duolette guitar that he plays, the classical and...
I don't know
if you know.
Yeah, I know of it.
He flips it over and it's, you know, gut string, flips it over and it's you know, dreadnought. Crazy guitar. So anyway, Michael replicated that guitar in a necklace and just presented it to him. So over the years, you know, here we are in Southern California, the heart, mecca, guitar, you know, where it all started. And one night, living in the shop, I was reading the Stuart Mack catalog. And I see this guy, R.C. Allen, in there, talking about R.C. Allen. And I was just telling myself, I was going, I'm going to meet this guy. Just like his epiphany, like, I'm going to meet this guy.
Sure.
And Michael O'Dorn being Merle Travis and stuff, we met him and of course, R.C. fell in love with Michael. He was just like, oh my God, this guy's it. You know, this guy's my kind of guitar man. So we friended R.C. and back and forth and I remember one day I just said, we're on the phone at Michael's house. And I go, you think we can ask RC if we can borrow that guitar or replicate it? You think we can do that? He said, well, we'll ask him. Such a vivid memory. We asked RC on the phone and his big long drawl of, we'll see, you know, we'll see. So, you know, a little bit later on, he loaned me that guitar.
And this was a guitar that you saw in the Stu Mack catalog?
No, I didn't see the guitar in the Stu Mack catalog. Okay. It was an article on R.C. Allen and El Monte.
So, what was this guitar that you were wanted to borrow?
The number 2 Bigsby.
The number 2 Bigsby. Okay, now it's making sense.
So... You know, he loaned Michael and I. He was really generous to Michael and I. And RC is not known for that, really. I mean, later on, I find out he's pretty much, RC was pretty much a recluse, kind of private dude.
Yeah. You guys probably weren't too far away from him, right? As the bird flies?
No, we weren't. So I got to frequent him often and see him and. He was a whole nother character, man. R.C. was just amazing. Amazing wealth of information and years of making custom instruments. All of a sudden, that got poured on me, and he became a mentor of mine, too.
And is he just...
And prior to that,
No, I was just going to say, is he just, like, regaling you with stories of Paul Bigsby and kind of going deep into it? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and because of Michael, you know, and all that, and then, you know, during that time, it was like, wow, that guitar is really historically important, you know? You think we can replicate that thing? And, you know, again, I was pretty young, too, still, you know? But still am. I don't know. What's your vintage, Jason?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm 44.
Oh, God, man. You're just a puppy, too. I mean, comparatively speaking, I just turned 53.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
So you get, I mean, you get, he lets you borrow this Bigsby. And I mean, this has to be like starting from scratch. If you want to build a Strat or a Tele, there are plans out there. There are kits. What are your steps? Do you tear the thing apart carefully, or what do you do?
Yeah, the non-operative word is not tear it apart. But I got plugged in my phone here. We wanted to find out how it was built, because we knew it was, you know, even to this day, Paul Bigsby guitars are known as solid body guitars.
Yep.
You know, everybody said, oh, the first solid. Well, far from being known, I mean, that thing's not solid. I was talking to Deke. I go, Deke, how come you still refer to this thing as solid body? Well, because it's always been solid body guitar. I said, but you still even call it a solid body guitar. None of them were solid. I mean, well, I can't say that. The first ones, you know, the first experiments, you know, with the solid neck and, you know, all those guys talking, you know, Bigsby and Les Paul and all these guys were talking together. Fender, they're all together. You know, going, oh, I do this. And these guys are going home going like, oh, I heard that. You know, I'm going to try that type of thing. But I think Paul Bigsby was, of course, he's a genius, man. There's no doubt.
So for folks who haven't looked it up or seen the Bigsby book, how hollow are these underneath? How many channels and how much space is there in there?
You know, they're various chambers.
Yeah.
They're laid out. You know, everybody has seen the Merle Travis, you know, uncovered. They took the plastic off, okay?
Yeah.
And you see how much that thing is hogged out. And we're talking number one. Here's Bigsby making number one. Hey, good try, Paul. You know, and it was, man, by all means, it was fucking brilliant. But he's got this plastic back on it, and he's got that bar, because man, he knew any more tension that pops the top is gonna pop off. So what, you know, basically when you build something first time, something, you know, you make all the adjustments in the next one, right?
Yeah. I mean,
most logical thing. Like, okay, I'm not gonna do that again. I'm gonna do this. And I'm going to, you know, beef it up here and stronger here. And that's what he did on number two, which was RC.
And how much of the chambering as a guitar maker, sorry to go off onto the deep end here, but how much of it was weight versus tone, do you think, in, you know, if you were to guess?
I think it was both.
Yeah. He knew.
I think he knew
that the
really
resonancy would, yeah.
Yeah, I think he really set out when Merle Travis told him, hey, I want to sound like that steel guitar. I want you to make guitar sound like that steel guitar. On a side note, when you hear Tom Bresch tell you the story in Merle Travis' voice, that's amazing in itself.
Yeah.
That's another guy you should cover.
Of course, yeah.
Tom's every bit of his father, and then some, with his impersonations. He told me that story with impersonating Merle Travis's voice. I tell you, I was in tears when I was working with him and his guitar I built. And man, anyways,
yeah. So. The way I'm picturing this, and tell me if I'm wrong, but like, you're making this one style of guitar mainly for rock bands, you know, maybe I don't know what era, if like hair metal was still a thing or not, maybe past that. Then you suddenly go down this rabbit hole of hanging out with RC Allen. He lends you Bigsby guitar number two. Is it all over then? Are you just like thinking about Bigsby all the time? Are you still kind of straddling both sides of the fence there? What's going on?
I'm totally both sides of the fence.
Okay.
I mean, it's like whatever I can create and make, and, you know, it's always been about, it just became about creation and, you know, really pleasing a guitar player and learning that from Wayne. Wayne would say, these are custom guitars. This guy wants this. I'm going to make this. And then, you know, we're going to expound it. And he made some really bitchin' custom guitars, man. He was amazing. Yeah. You know, first guy putting the humbuckers and Strats, you know, and he really had it going on as far as, you know, so from Wayne's side, I got the Leo Fender whole influence because he was doing all Leo Fender's work. That's another guy you need to do article on.
Yeah.
But he was doing all the warranty work for Leo Fender. They said, send it down to Wayne Charvel. You know, Wayne Charvel will do the Fender stuff, you know. So he's looking at all these Fender guitars coming in and just changing them up, and he starts putting paint on them. Hot rodding these doggone things, you know, pinstriping and flames, and like, holy shit, there's a whole nother world exists, you know. And that's when Eddie Van Halen was sitting on his floor coming in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I got both sides of the spectrum.
And what you didn't tell me what you actually did with the Bigsby number 2. Did you measure it, weigh it? What did you, you know,
what do you do as
a guy trying to copy that?
Well, being that my father was a physician, the first thing was to do is to x-ray it and see what's going on.
Okay, you know? Cool. It's good to have access to an x-ray.
It was Bigsby patient number 2, you know. And so I got these bitching x-rays of it, and we were just, you know, and what a blessing. My father's passed now in 2004, but when I saw those x-rays, I was just like, holy wow, this is how this thing works, you know? And it was just an epiphany of like, wow, here's this guy. And just a little bit afterwards, I was with Bernie Rico too. I got, you know, to share that with Bernie, because Bernie was always known as the father of the Helix neck through guitar. You know, he took a lot of pride in being the father of the Helix neck through guitars. Until I brought that Bigsby over to his shop. At this time he already moved up to Hesperia, California, and started more of an industrial shop area, bigger shop. And I had the opportunity to move with him, and I just couldn't see myself being in the high desert. He had horses and everything, and I'd go frequent and visit him. And now Bernie was like a second father to me. He was really a cool dude. But anyways, so I x-rayed the instrument through my dad's shop, and pretty interesting to see the look on my dad's face too. I'm showing him the x-ray of when they all come out. And anyways, from there I started making some ideas and templates and drafting the guitar. I drafted it up, and one thing was leading to another, and I started some replicas, and just went for it, you know, just started making them. And that's when I was thinking, God's like, well, you know, if I really want to do this, I got to be able to call it a Bigsby, you know, and see what I can do to make this thing happen. So I was bugging Ted McCarty. I ended up emailing Ted McCarty, and at that time he couldn't even see, so someone's reading him the letters.
Huh.
I'm just pouring my heart out. I want to make these things, you know. I want to bring back the Bigsby brand and all that stuff. And he just said, if you want to know any more, you come and see me. So I went to Kalamazoo, and that was in 1998, 20 years ago. And from that little meeting that we had, he was already convinced You know, to me, Jason, all this time, I'm winging and stuff. You know, I'm not. I'm just got this guy with crazy ideas and crazy ambition. And sometimes I think I lose it. You know, that whole drive and ambition at my later vintage here, because I've gone through some ups and downs, and I'm currently in a little bit of a lull. But we'll get to that. But anyways, I'm talking to Ted McCarty and.
What's his house actually, like? I want details here. You knock on his door?
Oh, man. No, we flew into Kalamazoo. A friend of mine, Mike Smith, and I. Well, I met Michael there. He picked me up at the airport, and we went to the shop.
Okay.
We got there the night before, and we went to the shop, and we went, whoa, there's the Bigby signs and stuff. We're just like, holy shit, man, we're here. You know, and we're outside taking pictures with the original guitar. RC let me take it.
On a plane?
For
wow.
Christ.
Yeah.
For Christ's sakes, man. I hear I got this Bigby guitar and literally handcuffed to me. Like, this, I can't believe RC let me do this. And yes, you know, RC was totally into it. He was totally backing up. And I was trying to get the Bigby, trying to get this thing. And, or you know, just trying to replicate the instrument. Not really the. But anyways, I'm talking with Fred. I mean, not Fred, talking with Ted, and he offered to sell me the Bigby company the day we met. I said, I'm gonna put something together. You know, we need financials, we need all this stuff to figure it out, and you know what your asking price and all that stuff is. That you know, and by this time, when I did that. I made a transition from Kalamazoo shop back to Hemet area where I actually got involved with a couple guys with a studio or building a studio.
Okay.
And that really intrigued me. So I was across the map and they asked me to join them and they had a shop in the back and I was going to move my shop. And anyways,
So what did the Bigby brand consist of in 1998? Refresh my memory.
Vibratos,
yeah. That was kind of it, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And they also had, as a side business, they had the Flexlight company.
Okay.
Because now you imagine during the Floyd Rose days, Bigby went, you know, they drowned almost.
Sure.
So he got involved in making, keeping. Ted was just a hell of a guy. What an amazing man and amazing heart. You go look back at all the Gibson, Golden Era Gibson, and his team of people and how he ran those people. Amazing man, as you're well aware. Just, you know, and here you got Leo Fender and Ted that really aren't musicians still. But heck of engineers and seers of seeing things in the future, I guess. I don't know, but he ran a great team. And when he left Gibson, he bought Bigby, right?
Yeah.
66.
And did you try to buy it? Where'd you go with that offer?
Yeah, I did, actually, but I put all my eggs in one basket, and it slipped from me.
Okay.
And the family, you know, he was already 88, getting there. And the family, the daughter and the brother, son-in-law, they were, come on, Eric, you got to come up with the thing. And I put all my eggs in one basket. It's kind of weird.
Trying to get the money to buy it?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. And, later on, they were talking to Fred Gretsch, and Fred ended up getting it.
Yeah.
And I think when Fred got it, Ted said something about me to Fred, and that opened up some dialogue with Fred Gretsch, and I ended up getting an order for 12 Bigby instruments from Fred, which later soured.
Were you?
I'm. Yeah.
No, I was just curious. Like at this point, Have you only seen the one original number two Bigsby, or are you at a point where you're starting to become a historian and track down some of the other ones?
Well, we've seen some of the other ones at trade shows and
I know, you know, wherever. There aren't that many.
Yeah. Right. You know, I've come across several, you know, in seeing them, you know. And you know, learning from RC.
Yeah.
Certain aspects. But, what's the next question?
Oh, no. So the Bigsby, point. The official Bigsby partnership kind of falters. And
oh,
then,
yeah.
Are you just still building them as you can?
Yeah. I'm just making these, you know, just going along and, Fred ends up contacting me, and we're trading emails and, you know, and he asked me, well, how many would you like to build? And he ended up giving me an order for 12 of them. I fulfilled fulfilled the order, but he only accepted 8 of them.
Okay.
And that's when things went sour there.
Sure.
If you write a book, I'd call it Guitar Politics. And I've just been...
Going back to the original Bigsby design, like, are you winding the pickups yourself? Did you have to figure out what Paul was doing differently than some of the other vintage guys?
Well, see, RC Allen and I were making these pickups. Mm-hmm. I, you know, created the casting and had, you know, started casting these pickups. And RC was part of the winding coils and providing other parts and assembly. I mean, we were making, you know, basically what we didn't even call the Bigsby pickup. Outside of the whole Bigsby thing, we're making RC Allen California Customs, you know. So it was based on those designs, but not all of them totally, you know, spot correct. You know, we're, you know, they're derivatives of Paul's stuff and his designs. And so we're, RC and Allen and I were both making them.
Got it. Cool.
And
then I guess that brings us to the Bigsby that I saw over at Ry Cooter's house. What was that, and how recent was that in your development, and tell me about it.
Well, I told when I brought that over there, Danny has been a good friend of mine, Danny McKinney, Dandel,
mm-hmm.
Requisite.
His guitar guy, yeah.
Danny, the Green Man.
The Green Man guy.
Man, another genius. I've just been fortunate to be around geniuses, I think.
Yeah.
And step in their shadows, really, because all these guys are just, they're amazing. All in their own ways. And anyway, so Danny, way back in the day when I was doing the stuff and I was trying to purchase Bigsby and stuff, I ran into Frank Garlock who used to help Bob Crooks with Standell, and they wanted to bring back the Standell, you know, brand. And Danny was a young kid, you know, hanging out with these guys and, you know, hanging around the Standell factory and learning all this stuff, electronics, and met Bob Crooks back in the day. And anyways, he was likely candidate to start Standell back up, and that's what was happening. And when I met Frank Garlock and told him I was doing this, you know, replicating some Bigsby guitars, and he said, come with me, you know. And Frank was from outer space, man. That guy was like, I think he was like a Palladian or something. He had to be like some other entity, man. He's an amazing guy. But he helped put the Bob Crooks on the map. Standell, and Danny started replicating that 25L15, and, you know, Bigsby and Standell pretty much went together, mm-hmm. like peanut butter and chocolate.
Yeah.
So we end up hanging out, and you know, periodically RC owned Merle Travis's Standell amp, so that was another in as far as the history and the historic aspects of it. You know, here we got Merle Travis's 25L15, the real deal. And which led up to going to the Sandell factory and A being the first 25 L15s against Merle's amp and other amps that existed. So that's
and then
man,
and
you're pulling it deep from me.
I'm trying. So you
well,
you
that's cool. It's amazing I can remember this shit.
So through Danny, you're able to meet Rye, and what guitar did you end up lending?
Danny, get this. So Danny's been working with Rye for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, and Rye came to Danny and says, you know, I've never been, you know, a steel player in the traditional sense, you know, but he had that 8-string Bigsby. I think he just purchased a Sava Reverb or something. He's guitar geeking and buying new things. And he gets it, and he's just going, fuck, I can't, you know, I really can't play this fucking thing. Danny, what do you think if we, you know, make like a traditional guitar out of it? And he goes, take this thing home, Danny, and see what, you know, what you come up with. And Danny was messing with it, scratching his head, took it all apart, this and that. And he's just going, what the hell am I doing? He put a Tele body under it. He goes, wait, this doesn't make sense. You know, the 8-string steel on top of the Tele, it looked bitching.
Yeah.
It looks bitching with the Tele body. But he's going, Eric, you know, Eric Bigsby, you know, making these Bigsby things. And he goes, Eric, you know, he called me up and goes, I got this project, you know, will you be interested in? I said, yeah, I'll do something, you know. And, this was last year, about in October.
Okay.
Last year, this time. Yeah.
And so you made that.
Yeah, I started going after it and creating a, you know, traditional type of instrument with the 8-string Bigsby steel attached to it, so Rye can play it upright. Sitting down or standing up, you know?
Yeah.
But, it was definitely a unique thing to attack the guitar like that. So I think that's why he's not really bringing it out yet, too, because I think he's honing his skills on it, too. Maybe. I don't know. Did you see it?
The one that we took the picture of?
No, not the one that you took the picture of, but the 8-string.
No. I didn't see the 8-string. But yeah. I don't know where. Yeah, I mean, he's probably got guitar squirreled away all over the place.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then the one that we took the picture of that runs in the Electric Guitar Annual that we just put out. What did you give him? Or
well,
him
that the day I delivered that guitar, the 8-string, he fired it up and it was just like, oh wow, man, oh wow, this is wow. You know, it's like, and he was really stoked. And I said, well, hey, I brought a couple other instruments out in the car. Let me go get them. And I, you know, brought a couple Bigsby guitars that I built and unzipped a couple bags, and I handed them that one that you took a picture of, that Ruben took a picture of.
Yeah.
I handed it to him, and when I handed it to him, just came out and said, I said, Rye, this one's not for sale. And I got the Rye Cooter Eye. Mm-hmm. I was like, at the same time, I was handed to him. It was just like, if I could take a snapshot, I was just like, oh, no. I got that eye looking at me like, what are you talking about, you know? And after I read the story and get into it, I'm just like blown away by what he says in there, in the story about other things, because it really, it came from our conversation about Bigsby and stuff. And he's talking about, you know, Leo Fender building Mavericks and Pintos, comparatively mm-hmm. speaking. I mean, I'm just like, you know, these are things that, you know, we were discussing, and he's saying it, and, you know, it kind of, to be able to give him some insight after all these years, and him being, and later on you find out more about Rye, but him being really influenced by these hillbillies when he was a kid.
Sure.
Is just dumbfounded. I'm just in awe and dumbfounded by it. Like, gosh, man, I just smacked him with full circle. You know, like Merle Travis and all that stuff, and these hillbillies. His dad wouldn't go let him go to these concerts and listen to, and he got in all that. But so I hand him the guitar, And he's playing and goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. This is cool. This is really cool." And, you know, explaining to him how he explained to you, like, you know, how the guitar is built and what he, you know, he's basically giving away my juju, you know, which you captured, and it couldn't come from a better source, obviously, you know, like that. But anyways, because I said this one's not for sale, but I'll loan it to you. Oh, yeah, yeah. You want to leave this one? You want to leave this one? It was like, golly, man. I tell you, it's like being with a 3-year-old and toys. I mean, you're totally aware of how he's just infatuated by anything with strings. I mean, this guy's just, that's all he does.
Yeah.
That's all he does. I got mutual friends that know him. That's all they did. David Lindley smoking Hooters and Rye's just like going at it. And, you know, reading all these stories about him with the Rolling Stones, and the Stones never had it together because they're all fucked up and partying and stuff, and Rye's just honing his skills all the time. And when are we going to start this thing? You know, we're not ready yet, Rye. You know. So anyways, I end up leaving the guitar to him, and we exchange emails and stuff and whatnot, and he came back to me on an email. I said, "So what do you think about the guitar, Rye?" It was, "Well, Eric, it seems to me like all my other guitars are inconsequential." I'm just like, holy shit, Jason. That is just like, what? Right? I mean, that's high tone talk you're talking, you know? That's like, that's amazing. That even this guy's reacting to this guitar like this. I'm just like, man. Because I've had a lot of great players. You know, and I built several. I built Warren Haynes one. He's got a Bigsby. He digs on it. It's kind of strange coming from Rye. It's a whole different thing.
Sure.
I can't even believe I'm saying this shit. You know, I can't even believe I'm talking about the guy. I mean, because. Anyways, later on, he ends up, him and Flip Scipio are pretty good friends.
Yeah.
And Flip has done a lot of work for him and stuff. And I guess a while back, he traded an email with Flip that he shared with me. I was just like, later on, you know, Flip was like looking at my stuff, I guess, and making some comments on Instagram or whatever. Ended up talking to Flip later on. He was kind of holding back for a while what he said, and later on I end up talking with Flip, and he says, "Well, hold on, what's your email? What's your email? I'm gonna send you something." He sends me this email from Rye talking about this instrument, and I lost sleep for 2 days. What he said, Jason. I mean, I totally was like, you know what? I've had guitar players going, "Oh yeah, this is okay. This, yeah, you know, it's all right and everything." But when Rye Cooter like says that stuff, it's like, holy shit, I stepped in something, like, I stepped in it again. And if I can use this, it's all over what he says. I mean, it's amazing what he said. I can read it to you, but just in confidence. So I'm like, what the hell? And he's telling Flip this, so Flip is just flipping out, literally flipping, like, who is this dude and what's he doing that you're all up in his, you know, and let me see if I can find it. I took a screenshot of it. It almost makes me fucking lose breath, Jason. I'm telling you, it's no joke. Here it is. And I love the way Rye talks.
Sure.
He's just a clip of, him talking to Flip, and he says, "Well, sure, this new record," in quotations, "is just me and Jay, basically." He's talking about Prodigal Son. He goes, "I've had a bitch of a time trying to put together a touring outfit." He says, "Nobody at my age would attempt it. All the old timers and the youth timers, they have their situation ready to go. One interesting thing, through Danny, quotation, Green Man McKinney, I met Eric Aletta. a Bigsby expert maker. Okay, whatever. He had x-rayed the second Bigsby fixtures and understood the inner workings. He brought his Merle clone to the house. A revelation, he says. Best sound I've ever heard and dynamic beyond belief. Bigsby really had it down. I could seriously dispose of all my other electrics now, but seriously, it plays itself and seems to sustain like a 9-foot grand piano. If I had had this 30 years ago, I might have had a career. I'm just like, what the fuck? That is crazy words.
Well,
and Flip is sharing this with me, and Flip is just like, dude, if you have a guitar like that, and Rice Hooter is talking like that, and I said, well, Flip, you know what? It's not me. It's the spirit of Merle Travis, Paul Bigsby, and R.C. Allen, and that's it. I just had the wherewithal. I stepped in the shit. I x-rayed the guitar. I just, you know, reverse engineered and came up with them. But I don't attribute any of that to me. I mean, the fact that I can share something with that later comes out of that is great, you know.
Sure.
But
well, what going back to that original Bigsby guitar design that makes Rye and others flip out. Like, you know, obviously to the layman or even the casual guitarist who's never been up close to one of these, you see the bird's eye maple, you see the design, it looks sort of, you know, it's a cool design, but what is going on underneath, what's going on kind of behind the scenes that makes some of that magic in your estimation?
Well, Rye pretty much gives it up. I'll leave it at that. Because I, you know what, the thing is I know, and I've really, you know, those are my kind of, I don't want to sound like, you know, anything derogatory or anything, but I like to keep those secrets a little bit.
Sure.
Because that's what makes the guitar stand out.
Yeah. And are you, when you're making these replicas, are you at all straying to kind of bring them up to Eric code, or are you kind of just trying to be as faithful to what Paul did way back then?
Well, initially it was, and still to this day, it's all being just, you know, pretty much faithful to what he did, you know, regardless of, you know, exact pickup lines and, you know, all this, all that hocus pocus and all that stuff. It just, you know, the pickup is in its own self. It really is like one of the first humbuckers. Because you've seen TK stuff. I mean, that those pickups are really magical because the aluminum encapsulated coil. I mean, it's a Faraday capsule. It's like it's bucking the hum for all intents and purposes. They're mm-hmm. quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They're humless, really. So it's really there's no 60 cycle hum. I mean, as much as a regular single coil, you know, and that whole grounding system and the aluminum pickup, it's really keeps it quiet. But the way those strings vibrate, like he said, bam, like what he said, just like, I forget the exact word, boom, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
Right. When you hit those strings, that string is like, you know, and it's got its own unique voice. I mean, here's this guy, 1948, neck through. When, you know, when Leo Fender borrowed Merle Travis, I'm sure he scratched his head, because I sure did. Like, I never, you know, got into neck through instruments.
Yeah.
And so we're basically doing everything bolt on with Wayne and later on with R.C. Allen, there's some neck throughs coming through, but with B.C. Rich. But, yeah, I never got into it. So I was scratching my head, how am I going to make this thing, too? And with the help of R.C., God bless him, too. He set me straight on all that So I end up drafting the instrument and making templates and creating some prototypes from that. And that was actually my official number one that I handed to him.
Got it.
That I made. And later on, when Fred Gretsch was getting these things, he got, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, he's going, well, where's number one? I said, naturally, I kept it. what are you talking about? I go back and forth to it sometimes. Oh, yeah, that's the feel of that, or that's the look of that, or, because I was replicating RCs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to be faithful to it. And so I go back to it. Sometimes I just have to, you just have to get that feel again, And so, that's how all that happened.
Yeah, it's quite a tale. Cool, man.
All right, man. Well, forward to hearing it.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.